لا إله إلا الله. الله يا الله والله أكبر.
Democracy of Religion from Imam Khomeini's point of view. This is the words of Imam Khomeini. The rule of Islam is the rule of law. In this form of government, sovereignty is solely of Allah and Allah's law, commandment and decree. The law of Islam or the commandment of Allah has full authority over all individuals and over the Islamic government. All individuals from the Honorable Prophet of Islam, over all individuals and over the Islamic government, all individuals from the Honorable Prophet of Islam, Muhammad al-Mustafa, peace be upon him and his family, to successors of His Holiness and the rest of the individuals, are subservient to the law until eternity, the same law that has descended on behalf of the Almighty and exalted Allah and has been expressed in the language of the Quran and the Prophet of Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Spring of Truth. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi. One of the point of views of Imam al-Khomeini radhiyallahu alayhi is that he said, "We have reached the station at which our nation exploded all at once and set off a revolution. Such an explosion has been matchless. A nation that had lost everything in the former regime, including his human dignity, and had to depend on others for everything. Then, suddenly, that violent outburst and the revolution was on, and it was by the blessings of this morning sessions that brought together all the people and focusing on one issue." Now, Imam Khomeini radhiyallahu alayhi, obviously, first he's trying to say that the revolution that happened in Iran is matchless. We have not seen any revolution through the course of history that could match the revolution of Iran. It was an outburst. It was the entire nation in uproar trying to change. Even though under the previous regime, they have lost everything, even their own dignity. But that all had to change. And the Imam says, this all was possible. It all happened because of the blessings of the morning and processions and the majalis of Imam al-Hussein.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi
sallallahu alayhi.
The people who were attending these majalis, the people who were attending these processions, they had one aim in mind, and that is to revolt against oppression, to revolt against oppressors, to make a change, to seek justice, to seek equality, and to seek everything that you have been denied. In the same way Imam al-Hussein did, we will do the exact same thing. And that made people explode, not just revolt. They exploded. And such explosion never seen in history. Why? Because it is an outcry from the depth of the heart of people that enough is enough. We should not succumb to humility. We should not be taken for a drive. We should not see our resources go to our enemy while we suffer. Poverty and lack of education, it was ravaging throughout the country. And people were poor, poor. And they sit under the richest country on the planet. But the resources were going somewhere else. So people revolted. And the ignition to all this revolution, to this outburst and to this explosion, was in fact the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam that taught them to stand up for the right.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day,
every
night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
This gathering in Iran's town of Shahrereh is a tribute to a man who's known as the father of national security in Iran, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Ahead of the second anniversary of his assassination, Iranian people and senior officials gathered to commemorate him and mourn his loss.
General Soleimani is no longer with us, but his legacy will continue across the generations to come. His assassination is a huge miscalculation on the part of the U.S. He was an influential axis in the region, and his assassination led to the humiliating ouster of American troops from Iraq and then Afghanistan.
General Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He, together with commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was killed in 2020 in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against terrorism in our region. So by assassinating him, the U.S. sought to dispose of him to allow the terrorists to roam freely in the region to serve the interests of the American government.
By assassinating General Soleimani, the U.S. thought in vain that it will stop his anti-terror activities. But in fact, Soleimani is still alive in the hearts of millions of Iranians who will continue his path stronger than ever.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that resulted in the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. His efforts made him known as the nemesis of the terrorists in the region. In 2020, millions of people in Iraq and Iran took part in his funeral ceremony to pay tribute to him and bid him farewell.
2 years into the incident, Iranians still mourn the loss of General Soleimani. They say they will not forget his endeavors in the fight against terrorism, something which earned him the title of a national hero and the guarantor of regional security. Yusuf Jalali from the town of Ray.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani, says there's been relatively good progress over the past few days in the negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA.
The main focus of the negotiations was sanctions removal. We had several meetings with the EU coordinator and the three European signatories, both on verification and guarantees.
Iran says it will go back to its nuclear commitments only after it verifies the full removal of U.S. sanctions. Tehran has also demanded guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the JCPOA again or impose sanctions that violate the deal. A European source close to the negotiations says all participants agree that verification and assurances have to be reflected in the final document, but that there are still questions on how that is possible. So are these issues going to create major obstacles in the way of a final agreement?
Yes, it's a major problem because these European diplomats know quite well how verification can take place. It's not something strange. If the Iranians cannot use the banking system because behind the scenes the Americans are threatening banks, then that's a violation of the JCPOA.
Russia's lead delegate, Mikhail Olyanov, said he believed an agreement could be achieved in the first half of February, adding that although the discussions were difficult, there was steady progress.
General impression, business-like atmosphere, positive trends, recognized by everybody, by all participants. We need to be patient, persistent in our efforts, and we will overcome all the problems.
Informal consultations are set to continue within the framework of the Vienna talks. The eighth round will resume after a three-day break for the New Year holidays on Monday. Homa Lizki, Vienna.
France has broken the European record for corona infections, and nations across Western Europe are also reaching new daily highs as the pandemic has entered a new but seemingly less deadly phase.
The coronavirus right now is exploding right now in France. It's very scary to see. I saw over 200,000 infections in France in one day. So I'm nervous. I'm trying to get back to the United States right now, and I'm waiting for a COVID test right now. I'm very nervous. I want to make sure that it's negative so I'm able to get back home.
France currently has over 4 million active cases of corona, but 99.9% of them are classified as mild. Daily deaths are half of what they were a year ago, while shorter quarantines are being approved. Cases are soaring in part because many more people are getting tested prior to holiday gatherings, but France's hospital admissions are just a third of previous peaks. It appears increasingly certain that the new Omicron variant may spread like wildfire, but that it is significantly less lethal, causing many to have a cautious sense of relief.
Corona is mainly just a bad flu. It's only a serious risk for certain types of people. But for the overwhelming majority of people, if you get vaccinated, if you quarantine when you have symptoms, if you use common sense to protect yourself and others, then all will be fine.
The high transmission rate of Omicron does have some taking scientifically questionable steps not seen since the early days of the pandemic. Paris has just made face masks mandatory in all public places, even outdoors. Some nations, which aren't seeing an increase in cases, have banned public holiday festivities anyway. France, Italy, and other countries are debating making their health passes even more restrictive, which many say is an abuse of personal freedom.
France has long been considered the most vaccine-skeptical nation in the world, but measures which amount to either get vaccinated or live in social isolation have coerced 80% of the country into getting vaccinated.
One fact appears vital. In France, the unvaccinated are far more likely to be in intensive care than those who have chosen to be inoculated. What many are hoping for in 2022 is that Omicron truly does herald the end of the lethal phase of Corona 19, which would render moot the controversies and uncertainties over how to best handle the long-running pandemic. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Heavy hits and intense rhythm are immaculately employed to play an epic melody that tries to induce an image of a hero in the minds of listeners. The image of General Qasem Soleimani. This symphony orchestra is performed in commemoration of the second anniversary of the assassination of former commander of IRGC's Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
Tonight's event was an effort to use the beautiful medium of music to describe the character of a legend who is General Soleimani. Art is a universal language and it can easily connect to different nations.
Qasem Soleimani had many characteristics. To understand those features, we need different media, and music can better reflect his epic aspect. The aspect that made him risk his life to make our region a safer place to live. So tonight, artists try to play their part in paying him tribute and admire his great character.
The orchestra was performed by the IRIB Symphony Orchestra, which is affiliated to Iran's national television. The pieces were conducted under the baton of Arash Amini, who believes music speaks stronger than words.
The music pieces that were performed tonight have the capacity to be played in different countries. It's music, and music can be understood by anyone, no matter where they come from. So I think it's the best way to acquaint the world with the personality of General Soleimani.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for the fight against terrorism in the region. He is hailed for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. This earned him the title of a national hero in Iran. The country is set to hold nationwide commemoration ceremonies on the second anniversary of his assassination, slated for January 3, 2022.
There have been many events in the past days in Iran that tried to highlight the importance of General Soleimani's role in Iran and the region. These tunes try to communicate the same messages, except they use a more powerful language that needs no translation, the universal language of music. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israel captured Syria's Golan Heights in the closing stages of the regime's 1967 war on Arab nations and annexed the occupied territory in 1981 in a move that was not recognized by the international community. The UN Security Council, in its resolution 497, adopted unanimously in December 1981, declared the Israeli decision null and void and without international legal effect. Nonetheless, former U.S. President Donald Trump granted U.S. recognition to Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian territory in 2019. The administration of current President Joe Biden, which remains critical of its predecessor for its unilateral approaches, has not taken any move to reverse the decision. Amid the U.S. blind support, the Israeli premier unveiled a plan on Sunday to double the regime's settler population in the occupied Golan Heights from the current 25,000 with a multi-million dollar plan. The land is rich in water sources. Naftali Bennett said the move has been prompted by the Trump administration's recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan and the Biden administration's indication that it will not soon challenge that decision. Syria has reacted to Israel's decision to expand the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights, calling it a dangerous and unprecedented escalation and a war crime.
Israel continues with its settlement policy and systematic violations, which are war crimes. The Golan Heights is an integral part of Syrian soil, and we will work to return it in full to the homeland by any means permitted by international law.
In the light of the U.S. backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
The United States has approved its biggest defense spending bill in history, allocating $778 billion for the fiscal year 2022. President Joe Biden signed the National Defense Authorization Act into law on Monday following Congress approval. The proposed defense spending is up about 5% compared to the previous year. However, the surprising part of the story is that Congress has allocated about $25 billion more for the military than the Biden administration had requested for. The budget allocates over $740 billion to the Pentagon, while nearly $28 billion would go to nuclear weapons program. A good portion will be spent on hypersonic weapons and other advanced weaponry, raising the fear of another arms race with Russia. It ensures that the U.S. gives around $3.8 billion to Israel as part of its annual military aid to the regime. But around $7 billion of the hefty defense budget is for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a plan to strengthen America's presence in the Indo-Pacific region against China. That also means an open call for support for Taiwan, which China regards as its own territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tensions between Russia and the US-led Western military alliance, NATO. Many experts believe that Washington's claim of defending Taiwan or Ukraine are just pretexts to make the US military-industrial complex more profitable.
The military industry, military-industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, these are just pretexts for the profits of the industrial, military-industrial complex.
According to data released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in April, the massive U.S. military budget was by far the largest in the world in 2021. That was more than the budget of 11 other developed and developing countries combined. That despite the fact that COVID-19 forced many countries, such as South Korea and Russia, to shift part of their planned military spending to pandemic response. Critics argue that the unwarranted increase in defense budget could instead be diverted to address more urgent domestic priorities, such as social injustice or fighting against the pandemic. The critics also say that the budget is more than enough to vaccinate everyone in the world. In July, an anti-war group, Code Pink, warned that the proposed $25 billion hike in the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States. The group accused lawmakers of trying to increase the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of working class. The approved military spending bill also represents a bump from former President Donald Trump's last budget of $740 billion, which was then criticized by Biden's fellow Democrats. Upon entering the White House in January, President Biden pledged a massive overhaul of U.S. strategy toward the world to make it a better place. However, Biden continues to follow Trump's aggressive and warmongering policies, as the National Defense Authorization Act reflects that billions of dollars will go for the U.S. unending wars across the globe.
Hundreds of people demonstrated in Gaza City in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Protesters marched towards the Legislative Council building while shouting slogans against Israel and expressing their unwavering support for the prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli forces increased their attacks against Palestinian female prisoners. The issue of female Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive to all Palestinians. The protest was organized by the Al-Ahrar movement.
Palestinian female prisoners are being attacked inside Israeli prisons, and we will not remain silent. Attacking female prisoners is an attack on the honor of all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. They were beaten and their ribs were broken by the prison guards. We stand by the prisoners and we will spare no effort to secure their release from Zionist jails.
Palestinians believe that Israel can only be forced into releasing Palestinian inmates under prisoner swap deals. In late 2011, Hamas and the Israeli regime signed a prisoner swap deal under which Israeli soldier Gal Shalit was released in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the issue of Palestinian female prisoners is a red line that must not be crossed at any given time. Attacking and humiliating Palestinian female prisoners will not go unpunished. The Israeli regime will have to face all the consequences of attacking the female prisoners. As we stand here today, we say to all Palestinian prisoners that the resistance factions will always support them and that we will soon liberate them from Zionist jails.
Palestinian prisoners, including females, are kept in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities.
The Zionist regime is trying to commit genocide against Palestinian prisoners amid the silence and normalization of Arab regimes. We call on all Muslims to stand by Palestinian prisoners because Palestinian prisoners are fighting for a just cause. We have also sent a strong warning to the Zionist enemy over the issue of female Palestinian prisoners.
According to legal experts, the Israeli regime has long regarded itself above international laws and norms due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States.
People here are demanding international action to support Palestinian prisoners' struggle for freedom. Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including scores of women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least two dozen shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They're entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems. Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we want to address a very important question, a very simple question, and it's a very relevant question for all of us. That question is this. We know that in Islam, anger has been frowned upon. You know what I mean? Meaning we've been asked to control our anger, to suppress our anger, to not let our anger get control of us, and so on and so forth. At the same time, we know that anger is something good. If we didn't have this within us, this power within us to get angry, it would lead to many problems. We would become oppressed by other people. And, you know, our rights would be trampled. We wouldn't feel the need to stand up for our rights, and so we could ask the question as to why is it that anger is so looked down upon in Islam, or in to put it in other words, in what context would anger be frowned upon? In order to answer this question, or we could say this, that the anger that has been scolded and has been frowned upon in Islam is not something absolute or indefinite and unconditional. Rather, when the anger of a person overtakes the person's intellect and suppresses the intellect and does not allow the intellect and the power of reason to perform its natural and essential functions, and or in the case where a person's anger doesn't allow the person to listen to the voice of his power of reason and his intellect, in this case such an anger is reprehensible. We don't need to remind our listeners of the importance of the intellect and reason in Islam. Reason, and or which has been referred to by the word aql in Islam, is one of those very essential and inherent virtues of Islam, and it plays a very central role in the Islamic universe. There's no need to we don't need to remind our listeners about this. In fact, you've all heard the famous tradition narrated in the book of Hadith Usul al-Kafi regarding the intellect, that when God created the intellect, he said that it is by means of you that I will reward and I will punish. And we have traditions which state that the intellect is the proof of God, the hujjat of God in man. It's the inner hujjat in contrast to the delegates of the of God, which comes and manifests itself in the form of the prophets and the infallibles, who are the outer hujjat and proof of God. So when anger overtakes the power of reason and the intellect and doesn't allow it to perform its function properly, or it overtakes a person to such an extent that the person doesn't listen to the voice of his reason, in this case is anger reprehensible? A certain tradition narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam echoes this very theme. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been narrated to have said that anger is a part of insanity. Right? Why? The reason is that the person who becomes angry in most cases later on comes to regret what he did in the state of anger. Thank you for joining us on The Key. We were looking at the reprehensibility of anger in Islam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to EnglishRadio at irib.ir.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Open the door now, you're going to get shot. An officer in Rock Falls, Illinois, shouted at Nathaniel Edwards after a car chase. Hands out the window now or you will be shot, yelled a patrolman in Bakersfield, California, as Marvin Urbina wrestled with inflated airbags after a pursuit ended in a crash. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists David Kirkpatrick, Steve Eder, Kim Barker and Julie Tate. The piece is titled, Why Many Police Traffic Stops Turn Deadly. Stay with us for more. Open the door now and you're going to get shot, a police officer in Rock Falls, Illinois, shouted at Nathaniel Edwards after a car chase. Hands out the window now or you'll be shot, yelled a patrolman in Bakersfield, California, as Marvin Urbina wrestled with inflated airbags after a pursuit ended in a crash. I'm going to shoot you. What part of that don't you understand? Threatened a police officer in Little Rock, Arkansas, adding a profanity as she tried to pry James Hartsfield from his car. The police officers who issued those warnings had stopped the motorists for common offences, swerving across double yellow lines, speeding recklessly, carrying an open beer bottle. None of the men were armed, yet within moments of pulling them over, police officers fatally shot all three men. The deaths are among a series of seemingly avoidable killings across the United States. Over the past 5 years, a New York Times investigation found police officers have killed more than 400 drivers or passengers who were not wielding a gun or a knife or under pursuit from a violent crime, a rate of more than one a week. Most of the police officers did so with impunity. Only five have been convicted of crimes in those killings, according to a review of the publicly reported cases. Yet local governments paid at least $125 million to resolve about 40 wrongful death lawsuits and other claims. Many stops began with common traffic violations like broken taillights or running a red light. Relative to the population, BRAC drivers were overrepresented among those killed. The recurrence of such cases and the rarity of convictions both follow from an overstatement, ingrained in court precedents and police culture, of the danger that vehicle stops pose to police officers. Claiming a sense of mortal peril, whether genuine in the moment or only asserted later, has often shielded police officers from accountability for using deadly force. We get into what I would call anticipatory killings, said Sim Gill, the district attorney for Salt Lake County in Utah. We can't give carte blanche to that. In case after case, police officers say they had feared for their lives, and in case after case, prosecutors declared the killings of unarmed motorists legally justifiable. But the New York Times reviewed video and audio recordings, prosecutor statements and court documents, finding patterns of questionable police conduct that went beyond recent high-profile deaths of unarmed drivers. Evidence often contradicted the accounts of law enforcement officers. Dozens of encounters appear to turn on what criminologists describe as officer-created jeopardy. Police officers regularly and unnecessarily place themselves in danger by standing in front of fleeing vehicles or reaching inside car windows, then fired their weapons in what they later said was self-defense. Frequently, police officers also appear to exaggerate the threat that they face. In many cases, local police officers, state troopers or sheriff's deputies responded with outsized aggression to disrespect or disobedience. A driver talking back, revving up an engine, or refusing to get out of a car. What police officers sometimes refer to as contempt of cop. In dashboard and body camera footage, officers could be seen shooting at cars driving away or threatening deadly force in their first words to motorists, or surrounding sleeping drivers with a ring of gun barrels, then shooting them when, startled awake, they tried to take off. More than three-quarters of the unarmed motorists were killed whilst attempting to flee. "We have got to take him out," an Oklahoma state trooper declared over the radio in 2019 to patrolmen chasing a man in McAllister suspected of shoplifting. The police officers used their cars to force his SUV from the road, opened the door as it rolled slowly past, and shot from both sides, killing the driver, dashcam footage shows. A Tennessee sheriff ordered his deputies to fire at a motorist with a suspended license in 2017. "Don't ram him, shoot him," he later recounted saying, according to a body camera recording. "Knocking a man off the highway might tear my cars up." Struggling to subdue a driver, a few months later, a patrolman in Mound Ridge, Kansas, warned that the man might be reaching for a police sidearm. An officer shot him, another struck his head with the butt of a shotgun, and a third pummeled his body with a baton, killing him, though he never touched a gun, video records show. And last year, a body camera recorded a police officer in Las Cruces, New Mexico, warning a motorist that he would choke you out, bro, then pinning him in a headlock. A good little scrap, the police officer called it, before realizing that the man had died. Some families of the driver said that their relatives were not blameless. "I don't have my head buried in the sand," said Deborah Lilly, whose 29-year-old son, Tyler Hayes, had drugs in his car and tried to run away when he was pulled over for tinted windows last year by a sheriff's deputy in Hamilton County, Tennessee. "I'm just saying he did not deserve to get shot in the back." Over the next 3 months, the deputy shot at two other unarmed drivers, wounding one. Almost all of the police officers involved in these cases declined to comment or could not be reached. Advocates for the police argue that the dangers of stopping cars require readiness to use deadly force. "I have watched enough videos of a police officer who is not on edge enough, and his dashcam films his own death," says Larry James, general counsel of the National Fraternal Order of Police. "What are you going to do? Are you going to be indicted or are you going to be buried?" Traffic stops are by far the most common police encounters with civilians, and police officers have reason to be wary in their approach. They don't know who is inside a car or whether there are weapons. 10 police officers have been killed this year in such interactions, including a Chicago police officer who was shot in August by a passenger during a traffic stop for an expired registration. But some police chiefs and criminologists say that alarmist training about vehicle stops has made police officers too quick to shoot at times, resulting in needless killings of civilians. Academies and commanding officers often rely on misleading statistics, gory cop-killing videos, and simulated worst-case scenarios to instill hypervigilance. Many police officers are trained to place a hand on the trunk of a car as they approach it, to leave fingerprints as evidence if ambushed by the driver. "All you've heard are horror stories about what could happen," said Sarah Mooney, assistant police chief in West Palm Beach. "It is hard. It is very difficult to try to train that out of somebody." The overemphasis on danger has fostered tolerance for police misconduct at vehicle stops, some have argued. Prosecutors and courts give more leeway to police officers' decisions to use force at vehicle stops as a result of the exaggerated concern about the potential for police officers getting hurt, said Michael Janako, a consultant to police departments on officer accountability and a former Justice Department prosecutor. He added, officers would likely kill fewer drivers if there were deterrents. Some police officers involved in fatalities at vehicle stops cite their training, which for decades has stressed the perils of those interactions. In many departments, police academy lessons and daily briefings include a steady diet of body-worn camera videos that depict easygoing police officers being gunned down by drivers. Seemingly, every police officer in America has watched the 1998 dashcam footage of Deputy Kyle Dingheller's murder on the Georgia roadside, where he pulled over a veteran with a semi-automatic rifle in his pickup. Trainers and tactical guides typically emphasize that the vehicle stops account for more killings of police officers than almost any other type of interaction. Of the roughly 280 police officers killed on duty since the late 2016, about 60 died, mostly by gunfire, at the hands of motorists who had been pulled over, a New York Times analysis showed. About 170 other police officers died in accidents on the job. But the assertions about the heightened danger ignore the context. Vehicle stops far outnumber every other kind of police dealings with civilians. In fact, because the police pull over so many cars and trucks, tens of millions each year, a police officer's chances of being killed at any vehicle stop are less than 1 in 3.6 million, excluding accidents.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a genuine pleasure and an absolute honor to be with you guys and to have a share in your precious and valuable time. And I am ever so grateful that you guys take time out of your day to hopefully join in our little discussions that we have. I don't necessarily consider myself as a creative person, but I do understand that in life, you need to be creative. Some people are born creative and they lead pretty creative minds, and it can be developed. Let's hear a short story. You know what? Let's do that so we can get a better idea of what we mean by creativity. And we're going to be right back.
A man was exploring caves by a seashore when he found a bag with a bunch of hardened clay balls. The balls looked like someone had intentionally rolled the clay and left them out in the sun to bake. Perhaps some children made them while they were at the beach, the man thought. They didn't look much, so he took the bag out of the cave with him. As he strolled along the beach, he threw the clay balls one by one out to the oceans as far as he could. The clay balls would fly and disappear in the ocean. The man threw several clay balls in the ocean until he dropped one of the balls and it cracked open. Inside the clay was a beautiful precious stone. This excited the man and he started breaking the remaining clay balls. Each of it contained different types of precious stones. He found thousands of dollars worth of jewels in around 20 clay balls that was left with him. He had been on the beach for a long time and he must have thrown away many clay balls with hidden treasure into the sea. He could have had a treasure worth of tens of thousands rather than just thousands if he had not thrown the clay balls away. Most of the time we look at someone or even ourselves and we see the external clay vessel. The vessel doesn't always look sparkly and nice, so we never bother to look inside it. We tend to see and judge a person and deem them as less important than the ones who are more beautiful, stylish, well-known, or wealthy. We forget to look inside for the unique treasure that each one of us holds. May we not come to the end of our lives and realize that we have thrown away a fortune in friendship, love, or any relationship because we did not attempt to look for the gems hidden in bits of clay. Let us all relish the treasures each of us hold inside us.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Allah is very creative. let me explain myself. Allah is very creative in the sense that He has wisdom and He has knowledge, and because of His all-knowingness, all-seeingness, He has He always has full knowledge and awareness over all the paths, all the possibilities, and through His wisdom and through His infinite knowledge, He draws the perfect path. He arranges the perfect scenario. He organizes the most perfect elements for a certain result and outcome to appear. Off the back of that, and because we hold all of Allah's qualities and attributes within ourselves, we are Khalifatullah, we are the mirror of God on this earth and His representative. We possess those divine qualities as well. It's just a question of reinforcing them and empowering them and highlighting them within us. So when it comes to the sense of creativity we require in our lives, not just because of our career or our college degree or hobby or side gig or side hustle or whatever, not just because of that, but just being creative in life, in finding solutions, being able to think outside the box when we are stuck in a box, being able to look beyond the curb, look beyond that dead end, beyond that wall. It requires creativity. It requires insight. It requires a broad mind and a strong, well-established creative mindset. And we can only do that if we amplify the other attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that are within us, which is knowledge, which is insight, which is being able to have more of a bird's eye view toward life and its circumstances, and not just focus on my little self and my little problems and sort of sink my head into myself, into my chest, and focus only on these little things that are in front of my nose. But being able to see beyond all of that, sure, I'm not God, I can't know and see everything, but I can at least know and see everything within myself. If I spend enough time with myself, if I try to dissect my own self, my mind, my way of thought, my emotions, study myself, analyze and assess myself well enough to understand my feelings, my psyche, my mentality, my responses, my way of thinking, what goes on in my subconscious. Sometimes we are so estranged with ourselves, we don't even know how we think, you know? And sometimes we think something stupid and we end up doing that stupid thing, and it was so stupid that it takes me off guard. And I'm like, how did I do that even? It's because I haven't spent enough time with myself, and it's because I haven't tried to reflect those qualities of my creator in my soul, in my ruh, in my nafs, and upgrade myself. And that's why I lack creativity. The ability to face the problems of life, certain problems that could grind your bone and scorch your skin, with utter peace of mind and heart, because you have absolute reliance on your creator, is a form of creativity, because it's thinking outside of the box. The box that you're stuck in right now tells you you're broke, that you're ill, or that you won't ever find love, or that this career, or you're going bankrupt, or you can't pay mortgage or house loan or college loan or this or that or that or that. You're stuck at a dead end. Right? And you cannot see beyond this horrible situation that you're stuck in. You cannot see beyond the four walls of this box. That's all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.